Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business. From liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
You know success when you see it, or you think you do, the people in the spotlight. But what about those small business masterminds who succeed at making their money work harder? They do that by having a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, which now earns 5% annual percentage yield. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/Green Festival. This is Bloomberg Business Week. I'm Carol Masser.
And I'm Bloomberg Quick Take's Tim Stenovek. We're here every day bringing you the latest news from the world of business and finance.
Plus technology, politics, economics, all harnessing the power of Business Week reporters and editors.
Not to mention our 2,700 journalists and analysts in more than 120 countries.
You can download Bloomberg Business Week on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
You can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern Time on Bloomberg Radio.
Or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Well, it has certainly been top of mind for weeks, really months. Would Jay Powell get a second term as head of the U.S. Fed? Well, no more guessing or wondering. We know President Biden preserving continuity at the Fed by selecting Jay Powell for that second term as chair and elevating Lael Brainard to vice chair as the U.S. Central Bank grapples with the fastest inflation in three decades and really lingering effects of COVID-19. What's going on in Europe, a reminder that we are far from being out of this pandemic. Let's get to it with Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Michael McKee, with us in our Interactive Brokers studio here in New York. Bloomberg Economics Chief U.S. Economist Anna Wong on the phone from the nation's capital. Mike, let's kick it off with you. I can't say I'm not surprised. What is the important takeaway of the news from the president today, and now who is at the Fed?
I think you take away a couple of things. One is that the president has gone back to the old way of nominating Fed chairs, keeping somebody in office who's considered to have done a good job, not just by politicians, but by Wall Street, even if they're a member of the other party, back to the non-politicization of the Fed. Another thing that you can say is a bit of a surprise was Lael Brainard not getting the supervisory job, but that leaves open that position for the president to perhaps appoint someone even stricter on regulation, make the Elizabeth Warren wing of the Democratic Party happy with that nomination. We should get that in a couple of weeks. Overall, it means continuity. It means that Wall Street knows what the policy will be going into next year. It's not a question of what will be done. It's a question of when it will be done, and that'll depend on the data. And so they can start making some pricing plans as they go forward.
Bloomberg Chief U.S. Economist Anna Wong, you wrote a really fabulous piece over the weekend about how a Brainard Fed would differ from a Powell Fed. In the end, it's academic, right? Because she's the vice chair. But it was interesting, she opened her remarks on stage with the words, bringing inflation down.
And I was going to say, is
what
it not,
role will she play?
And is it not academic because she's got a really key role now at the Fed?
Yeah, well, a trick question. But I mean, what's your read on her policy going forward?
Right. So in my piece, I did talk about how even though Brainard seems to be more dovish, but she's at the core of who she is a very data-dependent and practical policy maker. Her experience in the past 10 years in D.C. had been reacting to these fire drills, these financial crises, first with the European sovereign debt crisis, and then the China slowdown in 2015, and a taper tantrum. And so I think what she is that she's going to look at the data And if the data is showing that, and she actually laid out three very clear metrics of when she will get worried about inflation. One, it is if the rental part, if she sees higher rents, that's happening. Two, if she sees that inflation is unanchoring, such as if there's this sign of wage price spiral, then she'd be alarmed. And we don't see evidence of that happening yet. And we're planning to write a deeper piece about how the Fed thinks about wage price spiral. And just the third, if there's more COVID shutdowns going forward. So we think that she will be data independent, data dependent.
Well, I have to say, and I'm going to jump in because, Mike, it sounds like, wait, I've heard that data dependent phrase a lot. It sounds like in terms of the kinds of conversations that we're going to have at the Fed are no different from what we were having before.
Yeah, and that was kind of the point of the nomination today, that we – know what we're getting with Jay Powell. We know what we're getting with Lael Brainard. And we should add that the vice chair almost never votes against the chair. So you can expect them to be, not only because they think alike, but because of the positions, they'll be in lockstep going forward in terms of what to do. But as Anna says, it's a question of what happens with the pandemic, whether or not the inflation numbers that we get start to roll over, and
right,
there's some evidence that some of them are, but we're still a long way from knowing. And then it's a question of, do they at the December 15th meeting decide to taper more quickly, giving them the optionality of being able to tighten sooner?
I got to say, the thing that jumped out to me, and I'm going to put this to both Mike and Anna. Anna, maybe to you first, is that I felt like the idea of an independent Fed was woven through everything. And if we saw anybody be independent, we saw Jay Powell, who was appointed by President Trump, but nonetheless stand up to him during his tenure. There is something to be said by that and the political win with that, Anna.
Yes, for sure. I think this is definitely a win for Biden, at least in the eyes of economic history books, for safeguarding the institutional independence of the Fed.
And Mike,
You know, one point that Mike mentioned about the surprise of Lael being appointed as vice chair, I think that there's also something there, because the vice chair post, for example, as Rich Clarida, he made of this post,
right,
he was basically the architect, the intellectual architect behind this new average inflation targeting framework.
Right.
And the next policy framework review could be as early as end of 2023.
Right.
And perhaps Brainard, who probably is the one who preferred this vice chair post rather than the supervision post, maybe she is thinking that she wants to leave a legacy at the Fed, and in the next policy review, she could push for climate change or create involved digital currencies.
Anna, we got to run. Thank you so much. Bloomberg Economics Chief U.S. Economist Anna Wong, along with Bloomberg News International Economics and Policy Correspondent Mike McKee.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic from Bloomberg Radio.
Back with us, Dr. Ian Lospader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone. He's with us on the phone in New York City. Ian, good to have you here with Ed Ludlow, one of my colleagues here at Bloomberg. What are you seeing when it comes to COVID? Because I think the fear out there, safe to say, is that what's happening in Europe is going to happen here in the United States. I've seen this movie before.
Yes, for sure. Hi, Carol and Ed. Hope everyone is safe and doing well. You know, I think what's happening in Europe with their fourth wave really relates to a number of things. One is a relatively low vaccination rate. Some countries only 60% or so for one vaccine. Other countries, Italy higher and Portugal higher. So there's some vaccine hesitancy. There's also breakthrough infections. So people who've had the two, as we know, after 6 months or 8 months with the Alpha vaccines, Delta is breaking through. In addition, those who are lucky enough to get the third booster, we really only have data for about 30 days or so after that. And it does seem fairly effective, but we don't know, you know, months later how effective it is.
Right.
And so in part by doing all of these lockdowns it's really somewhat unproven, right? So you're locking down people, some of whom have been already infected.
Right.
It's not as if you're doing it for the first time. And lastly, open borders. I mean, you've got people who are coming and going, and mm-hmm. people are not really being tested regularly. So I think there are a number of things that are contributing to what's happening in Europe. And I think in the U.S., our numbers are stabilizing. There may be a little surge after Thanksgiving, but I think we are looking at a few more months, but I don't think much more than that at this point, assuming no mutations occur.
Let me ask you real quickly, because I think, you know, Tim and I have talked to you about this a lot. I bet it's on Ed's mind. Like, in terms of getting a booster, if you're 6 months in, sooner if you've gotten the J&J vaccine, excuse me, if you haven't gotten your booster, go get it.
Right. Yeah, no question, right? 6 months out, all adults are now approved for Moderna and Pfizer. Some people are getting some reactions to it. Certainly very reasonable to do it. And J&J is a shorter interval, and any of the vaccines are fine for J&J as a booster. And that, we think, can be helpful.
The data is fascinating. You're right, because in Germany, there are 15 million holdouts, right, who have not been vaccinated at all. And the country's kind of really ramped up its vaccination program, but all the doses that are being given out are boosters. So how do they fix the remainder? What is the solution here? Is it a mandate making a vaccine compulsory, as they've done in Austria?
Really, you know, the approach to any pandemic is prevention with vaccines, testing. People should be tested, nasal swabs or spit tests, antigen, and treatment. And we do have some treatment that also can be preventative. In other words, there are monoclonal antibody treatments that are very effective if given within 7 to 10 days. There are also monoclonal shots. You know, we've been dealing with this 2 years, and we should have been doing more extensive studies on ways to treat and not just rely on vaccines, because obviously not everyone will get a vaccine. So we do have some options. These are not cheap, of course, the monoclonal antibodies. And I think you need a multi-pronged approach. Just taking one approach, like vaccine or lockdown, one size does not fit all. You know, we really should have several approaches.
All right. So I want to know, as Ed is in London, he's not normally there. He's normally in San Francisco. So he's doing some traveling. People are traveling. I got on an airplane, as you know, for the first time in October. I was at the UBS Arena. We did a live broadcast. There were lots of people, workers, professionals, you name it, everybody walking around for the most part without masks. What's your advice, though, as we continue to move forward when it comes to mask wearing?
You know, unfortunately, the vaccines are not all perfect, including boosters will help. Masks, again, unless they're N95s, are not perfect. If you're flying on a crowded airplane and they're not testing people beforehand, that's all a bit of a risk. Stay in shape, take some vitamin D, get your levels up. Certainly get tested if you feel it's sick at all before and certainly after the flight. You know, fortunately, we're most people, not all, are vaccinated, and I think it's a calculated risk. But I think we have.
Well, I mean, come on, all of this though, this all sounds like common sense stuff. Is the biggest takeaway from this global pandemic just that prior to the pandemic we weren't that hygienic? You know, none of us have been washing our hands properly.
Speak for yourself.
You know, what
Ed
is
Ludlow.
The basic? Well, I'm just asking. Is this the reality from here on in?
No, I wish it was as simple as just washing hands and coughing and masks. I think all of those help. This is what pandemics do. Not everyone is vaccinated at the same time. It spreads around the world. It usually takes 3 years if you're going by the 1918, you know, Spanish flu, the H1N1. And I think we're a little naive to think that we could have controlled this perfectly unless we had been more aggressive very early on and developed treatment more early on and got everyone vaccinated early. Right. On. So once the cat's out of the bag, we're dealing with really what are natural consequences. And I think we like to think, oh, if we lock down or if we do this or the mask is the right approach.
Right.
I think they're all helpful, but it's not going to solve the problem, I'm afraid.
All right. Going to leave it there. Ian, have a wonderful and safe Thanksgiving.
Too.
And so good to check in with you. We'll talk to you next week. Dr. Ian Lusbader, clinical professor of medicine at NYU Langone Medical Center, on the phone in New York City.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization. We live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
So this week's special double issue at Bloomberg Business Week magazine, it's out on newsstands, online at Bloomberg.com, BusinessWeek.com, and of course on the Bloomberg Terminal. It's an inflation takeover. Several stories looking at the ugly green monster from several different angles, including whether Fed Chief Jay Powell will need to take a page from the playbook of one iconic Fed head and the tough decision that he had to make. So let's get to this story. The person who wrote it is Bloomberg News Markets editor Joe Weisenthal. He's in our Bloomberg Interactive Broker studio joining Ed Ludlow and me. Hey, Joe, I love this story.
Thank you.
I love the whole inflation takeover because it's like inflation's back, but do we need to be so freaked out about it? Tell us about Paul Volcker and what he had to do going back to his tenure.
So the Fed has, for a long time, had this dual mandate of, you know, stable prices and full employment. And inflation in the late 70s, early 80s was perceived to be getting so out of control. And Volcker is remembered essentially for having the temerity to induce a recession. And millions of people got out of work, but that broke the back of inflation. And
he raised rates.
He raised rates very aggressively until it... meaning until it induced a recession. And in doing so, that, you know, that kind of put an end to inflation. And then we had this sort of multi-decade period of pretty stable prices since then. The question, you know, now we're coming off of like 10 years of underemployment of the great financial crisis, chronic underemployment. We still have 5 million, at least maybe 6 or 7 million underemployed. And so the idea in my piece was like maybe to pull a Volcker in the year 2021 is to ignore the inflation side of the mandate for now, the opposite of what Volcker did, and make the commitment on jobs, which Powell has done multiple times, and make the bet that inflation is transitory, as the Fed more or less still believes.
The timing is interesting though, right? Because Powell has stressed a commitment to maximum employment, not just for weeks, but for months. And then you got that really hot CPI print for October. You know, I wasn't around in the 70s. I wasn't around in 1990 either when inflation was like this.
That's why we have history books, guys.
Right, exactly. But, I mean, did that inflation print change things for Jay Powell and the Fed?
It was, I mean, it definitely changed the political conversation about inflation. And I think that, you know, there were a lot of people, that number, rattled the White House clearly. And since then, we've seen Biden talking more about inflation and even trying to pitch some of his fiscal plans as inflation fighting. I'm not so sure. I think most people don't really buy that completely. Regardless, that's how much it jarred the politics. It got a lot of people to say, the transitory is a myth, etc. And so it certainly, if nothing else, ratchets up the heat on politics. Like, all right, do you really have the... Like, how convinced are you, Jay, still that inflation is transitory? And I think the heat has now been turned on the Fed a bit hotter.
So, Joe, what's the economic – like, I'm thinking, okay, yeah. I'm bringing out my economic books and trying to understand. So if he continues to keep rates low, is that going to then encourage more people to come back to the workforce because the economic momentum will continue?
Is that the way to think about it perhaps is not that low rates – will encourage people to come back per se. Because look, people point out, it's like, look, you cut rates to zero, that doesn't suddenly make economic growth happen. What I think you can say is the opposite, that for rate hikes to have an effect on inflation, you really would need to go hard.
Yeah.
That if you just hike rates 25 basis points, 50 basis points, you're not doing too much. And so I think the argument is more that, okay, you want the Fed to take care of inflation. This is what it's got to be. It's got to be a real series of hard hikes. And is that something you want to do with a 5 million employment hole? Do you really want to like go down that road of slowing demand when there's so many people still who want to come back into the workforce once this pandemic and other live disruptions come to an end? We're still in the middle of a pandemic.
Joe, it's an unfair question, but it'd be remiss of me not to ask about the new duo.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
A Brainard-Powell combo.
Yeah.
How would that have changed how you've gone about writing that piece?
You know, I think, to be honest, I don't think there was as much daylight on monetary policy as some people like to imagine. I mean, there was this perception of, like, Brainard having been more dovish. I don't really think that's...
Expansionary.
I don't really think that's based on all that much. I think more or less if you look at their track records, they're probably more in line. I suspect that Brainard believes a little bit more in perhaps some of the Fed supervisory roles, perhaps believe that the Fed can take on more climate responsibilities, although Chairman Powell has talked about that recently too. But, you know, from the perspective of the markets, from the perspective of like gauging what the policy path of rate hikes, I would be surprised if either one had a sort of like materially different vision in mind about the existing trajectory.
One thing I wonder, too, is that if I think about the economy, as you kicked it off with, Joe, is the idea that, you know, rates were so low for so long.
Yeah.
Like this was, you know, we've got a generation easily of people, yeah. investors on Wall Street who have never seen a high rate environment.
Yeah.
So was that the true picture, or is it all of a sudden the bump that we're seeing kind of a catch up from all of those years of low inflation? Like what's the true picture, I guess, is my question.
You know, I would say two things. I mean, one is, you know, we did have 9 hikes starting in 2015, and the
That's
market
true.
Absorbed them a lot better than I think a lot of people would have guessed. Because I remember in 2013, 2014, a lot of people was like, oh, this market is going to be dependent on ZIRP forever. And that didn't turn out to be the case. It turned out that starting with Yellen and then into Powell, there were a series of rate hikes. Then, of course, you know, we had the slowdown in 2018, so they got reversed in 2019. Then, of course, the pandemic hit in 2020, and that erased everything. But the market then showed an ability to withstand rate hikes. Look, I think that from a macro perspective, and Biden said this today, he's like, you know, we should pursue an economy where, and I don't know the exact words, but he said, where employers are fighting over workers rather than workers fighting for jobs. And if that were to be sustained, I mean, we kind of see it these days,
mm-hmm.
but if that were to be sustained for any like period of time, that would be a very different regime from what any of us are used to in recent decades.
It's a really good point. Very different economy.
Very different, yeah.
I mean, this is just ignorance on my part, but is there a policy path where they can meet the dual mandate? Surely one, as based on this, has to suffer at the expense of the other for the short term.
Yeah, I mean... Right. And right now, you would say, you know, if you just looked in isolation, you'd say unemployment rate at 4.5% and inflation at 6.2%. They're missing on the inflation side. The counter argument is that, look, some big drivers of inflation really do seem to be idiosyncratic or transitory. We know that used cars is still a really big factor, even after all this time. And that there's good reason to think that raising rates doesn't solve that. And are they hitting on the employment side? Not clear of that either, because although unemployment is low, numerous measures are still a long way to go. It's easy to imagine, though, close to full employment in 9 months and inflation starting to turn the corner and the dual mandate may be hit. So
listen,
I think it's still possible.
The drop-off in the economy and then the big bounce back so quickly has reminded you how quickly things can change depending on what's going on. Joe Weisenthal, it's a must-read. Thank you so much. He is Digital News Executive Editor here at Bloomberg News.
This is Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Masser and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
We want to talk about the Bloomberg New Economy Forum, which hosted its annual forum in person in Singapore last week. The event, as you know, from the many interviews and stories that we highlighted on air last week, is all about illuminating the challenges facing the new economy and really getting to the solutions and the voices who are in that journey. Here with a look back at the week, some of the major themes and newsmakers is Bloomberg New Economy Editorial Director Andy Brown joins us in our Bloomberg Interactive Brokers studio. First of all, congratulations. You pulled it off in person in Singapore. Tell us about kind of the mood of the event.
Well, thanks, Carol. It was an incredible event. We got 300 delegates, many of them CEOs, government ministers, entrepreneurs, scientists, to fly halfway around the world to Singapore to start working on big problems relating to climate and pandemic control and trade. It just felt like, this was the first really big gathering of its kind since the start of COVID. And what gave it this added urgency was that it was a few days after the end of COP26 in Glasgow. And so, the CEOs and Mike Bloomberg, of course, was there ready to think about the business end of climate. We had all these high-level commitments, pledges in Glasgow. Okay, how do we turn those now into real opportunities? How do we deploy the trillions of dollars that's necessary to reinvent our energy systems and transport systems? And so we had CEOs, bankers, financiers, government ministers sitting in workshops talking about just that.
Were people frustrated after COP26? I wanted to ask that. It was almost a sort of follow-on event because they happened in quick succession. Did they just pick up the discussion from Glasgow and bring it to Singapore, or was there a change of theme?
Well, Asia was the place to be because, as you know, Asia is where, the climate agenda is going to be made or broken. China, of course, is by far the world's biggest emitter, bigger than the next four largest combined. And the fastest growing emissions are from the newly industrializing countries in Asia. So getting climate under control, getting emissions under control in Asia is absolutely critical. And a lot of the conversations that we were having there was around how do we provide the infrastructure, the energy systems, and how do we supply infrastructure to work on mitigation and adaptation? Really basic things like, hurricane-proof roofs on hospitals. How do we provide the funding to make all that happen?
Well, and what's interesting, too, and I feel like right out of the gate, though, with the first comments, the first speeches, front and center was the relationship between U.S. and China.
Yes, that was the big one. And as always, Henry Kissinger is a sort of has wise counsel on that. Two years ago in 2019, when we held the New Economy Forum in Beijing, he warned that we were in the foothills of a new Cold War. That was a year after then President Donald Trump had launched his tariff war on China. Last year, it was a virtual event, and he was asked by John Micklethwaite, our editor-in-chief, whether we had progressed through the foothills and whether we were in the mountains. And he said, yes, we're in the high mountain passes. This was last year. This year, John was talking to him again, interviewing him on stage, and said, well, where are we now? And he said, well, we're through the passes, and we're at the edge of a precipice. And I think there was a real sense among a lot of the delegates that we're in a very, very dangerous place now between the U.S. and China.
What specifically? And I wonder if there were concern about some kind of military acts at this point involving with Taiwan. Like, what is it specifically that they see? Or is it trade? Is it business?
Well, I think it's, first of all, there is no dialogue. I mean, you know, all of the platforms in which officials from the two sides would get together, there was a strategic economic dialogue that Hank Paulson had helped set up, and all kinds of interactions, academics, journalistic, and so on. I mean, all this is now stalling out. So there's no real communication between the two sides. I mean, Henry Kissinger had talked about the Cold War, but in some ways, this is much more dangerous than the Cold War. I mean, in the Cold War, there were rules of the road. What would happen if you have an accident at sea or in the air?
Right.
There is nothing now, and you know, this is why Joe Biden goes into his meeting with President Xi Jinping saying, we've got to put guardrails around this.
Did anybody think that was significant, that virtual meeting?
Yes. And I think Kissinger saw this as being significant, that I mean, he had talked about being at the precipice, and I think the sense was that he felt that that meeting had started to take the two sides back from the precipice.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the hope is not that, you know, that the two sides are going to make up or anything remotely like that, but that we've reached a sort of a rock bottom. I mean, there were very low expectations coming out of it, but we've seen small, but I think reasonably significant improvements and concrete results coming out of it. For instance, restoring journalist visas. That's important. More important, an agreement for the two militaries to start talking. That's important. I mean, China is in the throes of rapid nuclear expansion. You know, over the summer, stunned the Pentagon with this hypersonic nuclear-capable missile. A lot happening on the military front.
Just got about 25 seconds. Do you have a favorite conversation? Am I able to even ask you that just quickly?
Yeah, the last day was really interesting. We were talking about great power competition and how smaller countries are going to line up in this. And the sense in Asian countries is we really don't want to choose. Yes, you're our friend, United States. You're our ally. But you know what? China's our biggest trading partner.
Bottom line. Great conversations, Andy. And I know we scratched the surface, but thank you so much for breaking it down. Andy Brown, editorial director at Bloomberg New Economy. You can sign up for the New Economy daily newsletter at Bloomberg.com/new-economy. And you can also go to Bloomberg and search on New Economy to listen to those conversations. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes Tim Stenovic. On Bloomberg Radio.
Talk about a possible monster combination. We're just talking about that of monster beverage. I know. I had to do it. Don't judge me.
Monster Monday.
I know. Well, Monster Beverage, we know them as, of course, the maker of energy drinks. Perhaps mixing it up in the beverage world by joining forces with Corona Brewer at Constellation Brands. Monster said to be exploring such a combination between the two, according to those familiar with the matter. So let's get into it. Monster, by the way, that stock is up about 1.5%. And let me pull up Constellation, if I may, and just get a quick check on what that stock's doing in today's trade. It is down about 0.4%. Ken Shea is tracking this. He's Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Analyst for Global Beverages, Tobacco, and Cannabis. He's with us on the phone in New Jersey. Hey, Ken, good to have you here with Ed and myself. So is this likely?
Hi, Carol, Ed.
Hey.
And Ed, you know, It doesn't surprise me that these firms would be chatting. You know, they all have different needs in terms of growth platforms. Constellation is looking for more diversification from its beer strength. It wants to get into soft drinks, low alcohol refreshers, as I see it, and it also wants to get into non-U.S. markets. It's by and large a U.S. company. Monster is very narrowly focused on the energy market, which is becoming more and more competitive. Yeah, they've had a great growth run, but the markets going forward are going to get tougher. PepsiCo is, you know, really setting its sights on this market, and others are. And then Coca-Cola sitting in the background with a 19% stake of Monster, it could be a player here too. So, and it has needs also to diversify from soft drinks. So all these guys need something to grow. And I think they can get assistance from another. It's the devil's in the details, though. We don't know where this is going to go and how they're going to figure it out.
Well, we all need something, whether it's a high caffeine beverage or an alcoholic beverage at the end of the day. But if you think about the mix of those two, the regulators will have something to say about this, won't they?
Yeah, the regulators have really pushed back hard on smaller players who try to mix alcohol and caffeine. And that's kind of a no-no in many markets. And so I don't think, you know, that's the obvious.
Ed, Ed's thinking, yeah, it's kind of a no-no to mix anyway.
Yeah, I mean, but I think beyond that, though, this is really, I mean, it could make sense as a joint venture between Monster and Constellation. As I mentioned, they can both help each other out. Constellation has tried hard to get into the hard seltzer market, and it hasn't really worked out well for them. Monster has a strength, perhaps, there. Monster would like to consider it. It said in the past it was going to consider CBD beverages. Well, Constellation's got a big stake in Canopy Growth. So there's some things they could do for each other.
What about, I mean, there's some interesting relationships, and you pointed out, or Ed Hammond points it out in our story that's on the Bloomberg about Monster having a relationship with Coca-Cola. That could be tricky. And then you've also got any transaction with Constellation would require the support of the Sands family, which has built the company into that global beverages player that it is today. How does that complicate those two aspects?
Well, that's certainly going to be a roadblock in terms of, you know, needing their okay to do anything. Having said that, though, Constellation, to their credit, has been a risk taker over the last few years. I mean, just think about the cannabis investment alone, Canopy Growth. They've been kind of a lone wolf there in that approach. Hasn't worked out for them yet, but I think over time it very well could. Coca-Cola with a 19% stake in Monster. It's probably kicking itself that it just didn't buy it years ago. It's kind of ran from
it.
Good
point.
But
well, now it's massive, though, right? Like this would be a mega deal, Ken, is what I was saying. You know, these are both $40 billion plus companies, and I wonder, like, how much of this is the experience of 2021 supply chain disruption, the ability to maneuver around that? Are these guys just looking for scale?
You know, it's a good question. I'm not really sure. I think this is what it sounds to me like, a more strategic venture into what they call white space, meaning markets that they're underserving, as opposed to, you know, riding through some cyclical pressure like, you know, supply chain. You know, that's kind of a cost of doing business. But I think that they really are looking for creating new products together. And Coke is going to be more than happy to have an indirect exposure to whatever Monster and Constellation, you know, conjure up. Coke will only benefit, again, given its equity stake in Monster.
Well, hey, you know what I'm thinking, Ken, too, for the investors that are listening and the Bloomberg audience that's out there on radio and on YouTube right now. So when it comes to the beverage industry, I mean, Coke has been phenomenal in kind of, you know, creating partnerships and going after lots of different brands. I mean, what will be the model going forward? Will it be an M&A one, an acquisition one, or will it be a joint venture or partnership one? And just got about 30 seconds.
I think this is going to end up a joint venture. I don't see these two companies merging. There's just too many dissimilar elements. I don't see a lot of synergies from a cost point of view. But I think they can certainly help each other from a joint venture point of view. And I think Coca-Cola can participate to a limited extent also, helping them both.
All right. Got a beverage of choice coming ahead of Thanksgiving, Mr. Shea?
Oh, I love my beer. So I'm a beer guy still. Yeah. Oh, yeah.
That was easy. Yeah. That was easy. Ed, got a beverage of choice ahead of Thanksgiving?
Yeah. Well, flat room temperature English beer. That's what I'm enjoying this week.
Such a Brit. All right, we're going to leave it there. Ken Shea, thank you so much. Senior Analyst for Global Beverages, Tobacco, and Cannabis at Bloomberg Intelligence. As I mentioned, shares of Monster Beverage, they're up, though, about 1.5%, and we're not seeing too much movement when it comes to Constellation. You're listening to Bloomberg Radio.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. You need a company with extensive experience in specialized insurance. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and helping provide coverage that suits your needs. The Hartford offers insurance solutions that help mid to large-sized businesses, like yours, effectively manage risk, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. With extensive experience in underwriting, risk engineering services, and claims, The Hartford goes beyond the expected to deliver innovative, customizable solutions and service that your industry, that your business, demands. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest-growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's STIFEL.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You know success when you see it. Or you think you do. The people in the spotlight. Athletes, actors, artists. But what about the people behind the scenes? You know, the ones who make it all happen. The lighting engineers, the sideline photographers, the caterers. They're small business masterminds. And if there's one thing they have in common, it's making their money work harder. That's why they have a business bank account with QuickBooks Money, where they are now earning a generous 5% annual percentage yield. Yes, 5% APY. Making your money work as hard as you do? That's how you business differently. Learn more about QuickBooks Money at quickbooks.com/5APY. Banking services provided by Green Dot Bank, member FDIC. Only funds and envelopes earn APY. APY can change at any time.
I'm driving in my car.
Hey, how about you let me drive?
Oh, no, 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 no. This is not a toy.
Who's gonna drive you home?
Honey, please, I'll do the driving.
Drive on.
Excuse me, I want to drive.
Keep driving crazy.
It's the question that drives us.
This is the Drive to the Close.
That funky music will drive us till the dawn.
On Bloomberg Radio.
All right, just about 10 minutes left in today's trading session. Watching the markets, certainly the equity markets moving around here. We're taking a leg down on those major equity averages. Still in the green, though, significantly, or at least more definitively, for the Dow Jones Industrial Average. Call it flat on the S&P 500. You heard Doug talk about this. NASDAQ, though, down by 136 points. But it really does feel like it's a day where the Treasury curve was something we were all focused on, especially as you saw the shorter end, but both the 2 and the 5, really along the yield curve, those yields moving up. Let's get to it with David Dietz, Managing Principal and Senior Portfolio Strategist over at PPAC Private Wealth Management. $10 billion in assets under management. And David's back with us on the phone from Summit, New Jersey. David, good to have you here with myself and Ed Ludlow on this Monday. First and foremost, the Fed meeting and the Fed, president deciding on a second term for Jay Powell, but Leo Brannard also having a very significant position on the Federal Reserve.
Yeah, obviously it was a very difficult decision for President Biden. He delayed it far longer than anyone expected. I think at the end of the day, this is a real positive for the markets and the economy. And here's why. Although they're both very strong economists and Fed representatives, the fact of the matter is, Powell's more of a proven quality. He's been running the Fed since 2018. He did a magnificent job backstopping the economy during the worst pandemic in 100 years. He's a proven quantity. So I think the markets are cheering his renomination to another four-year term. The other thing, of course,
what's the cheering that's going on? What are you seeing in the cheering? What aspect of the financial markets and the trade today show you cheering?
Well, I think that the particularly with the movement in the Dow, that's being driven by strength in reopening stocks, cyclicals, and particularly financials. And so there, of course, if there was a difference between Brannard and Powell, is Powell is perceived to be a slightly lighter touch on regulation of banks. And you're seeing very strong movement in the banks today. Of course, you got Travelers, Goldman Sachs, JP Morgan in the Dow, which is helping lead it. And so the feeling is that it will be a little less risk of onerous regulation by Powell going forward than we might have seen under Brannard.
David, I think I'm right in saying that you're a firm believer that markets set rates and not the Fed. Where do we go from here, given these appointments?
Well, you know, at the end of the day, I think interest rates are likely to head higher. Why is that? I think the key drivers here are, of course, ultimately, I think a year from now, COVID-19 is going to be less of a problem. Sure, there's a lot of scary scenes and headlines coming out of Europe, but the fact of the matter is, when you look back a year, we've got so many more tools, Ed, to deal with COVID-19. You get three vaccines, you've got the antivirals. Now, just about all adults will be able to get a booster shot here. So we're likely to win this war. I think that is going to continue to spur the economy. And of course, as the economy strengthens, people have more confidence. I think you're going to have more spending. That's going to add to inflation. The more inflation you have, interest rates go up. And I think there's going to increase confidence in the business sector to borrow more money. Both of those things, I think, are going to start to push the interest rates up. And remember, we're trying to get back to normal. As recently as 2019, we saw 2.9 on the 10-year treasury. We're nowhere close to that now.
Well, does that then hearken a Fed and a Jay Powell Fed being much more aggressive when it comes to raising rates? If you sound pretty optimistic, safe to say very bullish. And so having said that, does the Fed need to be even more aggressive when it comes to raising rates at this point, David?
Well, I think if I'm right that the economy strengthens and COVID wanes, I think you're going to see more inflationary pressures. Offsetting that, of course, will be some de-bottlenecking, as it were, of the ports and so forth as more people can get back to work and help unload the ships and so forth. But I do think you're going to see more inflation. What we saw just recently, 6.2%, totally unacceptable. I think some of that's temporary, but some of it's built in. And ultimately, lenders will demand more. I mean, what we're seeing now, one of the reasons of the strength of the market is you've got a 10-year treasury at 1.6, but inflation's at 2.6. So it's negative real interest rates. Makes no sense at all. So I think interest rates will move up, and there will be pressure on the Federal Reserve to keep taking away that punch bowl to offset those inflationary pressures and normalize interest rates.
In the meantime, talk to me about the Tina trade. There is no alternative for global listeners who are wondering what Tina is. You know, where are the pockets of opportunity then, to your mind?
Yeah, absolutely. So if we're right that the things look good for the economy going forward, that people will start to engage in even greater numbers in the economy, then it seems to us that more cyclical stocks could get a tailwind here, while some of our pandemic favorites, you know, the Zooms and the Pelotons of the world that catered to people locked down, will be a little bit less in favor. So, so we see dividend-paying stocks, energy stocks, material stocks, financials. If interest rates do go up, their net interest margins will expand. That could be an excellent place. And when you start looking at valuations, smaller stocks, indeed, anything other than those top 10 mega caps look a little bit more attractively valued.
Is it weird and counterintuitive that we see rates moving up and yet we still had the S&P headed toward another record today?
Well, it's barely a record. Of course, we saw the
NASDAQ. Yeah, it's probably not going to end that way, but
and so what I do think is, you know, the S&P is that mix between those mega cap techs and the smaller Main Street mid caps and smaller caps. And so I think on balance, the news has been good and has pushed the S&P up. But of course, it has been weighed down by some of those NASDAQ names that we're seeing today, because of course, their profits are much further out. And if interest rates go up, the present value of those deteriorates a little bit. I think that's what we're seeing.
All right, we're going to run. Hey, David, have a good Thanksgiving. David Dietz, he's Managing Principal, Senior Portfolio Strategist over at PPAC Private Wealth Management.
Thanks for listening to Bloomberg Business Week. Download the podcast on iTunes, SoundCloud, or Bloomberg.com.
And you can also listen to our radio show at 2 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg Radio or watch us on YouTube. Search Bloomberg Global News.
Your industry is unique. It faces its own challenges and risks that set it apart. That means choosing just any insurance company just won't cut it. At The Hartford, we take pride in knowing the ins and outs of your industry and help provide solutions that suit how you do business, from liability and property insurance to workers' comp and more. At The Hartford, we don't just talk about specialization, we live it. Learn how The Hartford can help your business at thehartford.com.
Collaborate for a greener future at the Bloomberg Green Festival, a groundbreaking celebration of the thinkers, doers, and innovators leading the way, from design and culture to technology, science, and entertainment. Hear from inspirational speakers and immerse yourself in climate solutions, July 10th through 13th in Seattle. Title sponsor, Amazon. Official airline, Alaska Airlines. Get 20% off using promo code RADIO20 at BloombergLive.com/greenfestival.